Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hi, friends, and welcome to the Plus Mommy Podcast. I'm your host, Jen McClellan, and here we explore plus-size pregnancy, motherhood, and body love. From bumps to bellies, we talk about it all. Now, let's get started. Hi, friends. Today, we are joined by Parijot Deshpande, and she is a high-risk pregnancy expert, trauma-informed health strategist, author of The Pregnancy Brain, and I am just so thrilled to have this opportunity to connect with her and have her on the show. So welcome!
Hi, Jen!
I have been an admirer of your work focusing on supporting people around having high-risk pregnancies in a way that isn't shaming people or making people feel badly about themselves and really teaching people how to navigate not only the system, but their own relationship between their mind and body on working towards having healthy outcomes. And I just admire what you do, and I'm thrilled to have this opportunity to connect with you for the podcast. So thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Likewise, the admiration is absolutely mutual.
Thank you. Why don't you tell us, introduce yourself and kind of your journey to doing this work focused around high-risk pregnancy?
Sure. So hi, everyone. I'm Parijot. You know, it's so interesting whenever people ask, well, how did you get started? Sometimes I tell about it, I start with my personal story, which I'll share in just a moment. But really, the seed was planted when I was like 7 or 8 years old.
Oh, and wow.
My best friend's father is still an OBGYN. And whatever I understood of what his job was at that age, I was like, that. Oh, I want to do that. And so I was a child and I was pretending to be an OBGYN. That would be like my pretend play. And that's what I knew I wanted to be. And every single time I had a career report to do, I'd be knocking on his door going, want to talk to me again?
I love that.
So many interviews with him. He was such a good sport about that. And actually what took me off of that path initially was chemistry in college. I remember just sitting there going, my brain doesn't work this way. I don't understand what you're saying. So I took a little bit of a detour through clinical psychology, through first developmental psychology. I was focused on young children, infant development specifically, which I loved, and then went through clinical psychology. But there was always something missing. I felt like, oh, I really kind of want to get back to women's health somehow, but I didn't quite know how. And I was very early in my career when we had a conversation with a physician who said, essentially, you need to start trying to conceive sooner rather than later because your fertility window, because of some health complications I've got, is very small, even though I was in my 20s, which was a conversation that we were prepared to have. So we were one of those couples. We didn't try for very long. We went directly into fertility treatment. Again, like I said, I was in my 20s, and we just kind of jumped right in and said, okay, I guess here we go. And I experienced a ruptured ectopic with my first pregnancy, thank you. It was terrifying because we had never anticipated that my life could be in danger with a loss. Like, we've heard about people having miscarriages, which is so heartbreaking and life shattering, but we had never heard stories of somebody's life being threatened. And we just went, this is a different world mm-hmm. than we were at all prepared to be a part of. And I think that really shook the ignorance and the naivete just kind of shattered at that point. Went, yeah. Okay, what are we dealing with here? What is this? And so the next round, once I recovered a bit emotionally, I recovered physically, we jumped into IVF and I got pregnant, thankfully, on my first try. But before I even knew I was pregnant, I developed my first pregnancy complication. Mm. And that was the beginning of a really tumultuous, difficult pregnancy. I was on moderate activity restrictions at home from week 6 because I was bleeding so early in the pregnancy.
Oh my gosh.
My full life that I had, I was teaching at the university. I was running a nonprofit. I was seeing clients at a community mental health agency. Everything stopped. Wow. And I was just at home by myself, which is, as we just talked about, not something I do very well.
Yeah.
And it was a really eye-opening experience of being the patient now and going, okay, I'm terrified mm-hmm. all the time. And because I don't want to lose this baby. Right. I have already lost one. I don't want to lose this one, right? Not that you have to lose one to know what that's like, but you know, I didn't want to add to that count, really.
Right.
And it was around 14, 15, 16 weeks, something like that. I had been on at home since week 6, so 10 weeks or so. And I developed multiple complications by that point. And I remember being at home. I was alone. And I'm thinking, I am so anxious. I'm so anxious all the time. And I don't like this feeling.
Yeah.
Having been trained in clinical psychology, I'm like, okay, if I went to an office of somebody like me, I know what they would say to me. And now as the patient, I'm like, that is not at all what I need. I want somebody to tell me how to stay pregnant. I don't need somebody to tell me how to be less anxious.
Right.
And that really came to a head when I was admitted to the hospital at 22 weeks and 4 days. I was 3 centimeters dilated. It was the middle of the night. The on-call doctor was like, we're going to put you in Trendelenburg, which is where your feet are above your head. We're going to start some medication. Your team will come and talk to you in the morning. And they came in, my MFM, my OB, I'd gotten to know them very well by that point. I was seeing them like multiple times a week. And they both just were, how do we tell you this? But we're going to try. We just think it's likely you're going to deliver within the next 72 hours.
Oh my goodness.
And then here's all the data and all the statistics of what that's like for a baby born at that point, that gestational age. So we heard some awful, awful things. I know they had to tell us. And they were very supportive. And it was at that point I said, you know what? There's one thing nobody's talking to me about, which is how I can possibly modulate my preterm contractions by accessing my body in a way nobody else can access.
Mm.
So yes to all medications.
Yeah.
You've got my signature. Yes. Give me what you got. And I'm going to try some things that I'm grasping for straws here.
Right.
We're at the edge of the cliff here. I'm going to try some things and I want to see if it'll help. And so I focused on modulating my body. And in doing that, we could see on the monitors the contraction stopping.
Can you explain what it means to modulate your body?
Sure. I will try. Only because I could talk about this for hours. I'm trying to figure out how to say it in the most concise way possible. It essentially means adjusting the physiological state of your body from the threat response to physiological safety.
Mm. So that fight or flight that we get into in these really stressful situations, you're talking yourself and working yourself down?
Yes. So what we tend to do is we try deep breathing, mm-hmm. we try meditation, we try positive thoughts or affirmations. None of those things actually work. And we can definitely get into that. What we have to do is get it at the body level. We have to actually go, what does my body need to do to come out of this state? So if you mm-hmm. think about, for example, when we're in fight or flight, sometimes we get really fidgety, right? We just can't sit still and we're moving and we're, you know, moving our hands around or our legs are moving. It's because our body is looking for a way to release that trapped survival stress.
Yeah.
How do you do that when you're on medication in Trendelenburg in the hospital? trying to stay
laying
present?
Upside down, literally. Yeah.
That's what I was trying to do.
Wow.
Essentially. But it worked because every single time the nurses would come in and they had the monitors at their station, you could see it. When I was able to do that, when I was awake, when I was actively working on it, the contraction stopped and the medication was continuous. So nothing was changing.
Yeah.
And when I stopped or when I got scared or something happened, you know, there was a twinge or a pull or something happened and I got scared or the neonatologist walked in. I'm like, oh God, yeah, what are you going to tell me now? Contractions picked right back up. And so that was my goal. And they were lovely about it. They're kind of like, sure, give it a try.
Yeah, of course.
Sure. They didn't fully believe it was possible, which I understand because of what they see. And because nobody talks about this, they hadn't seen it enough. They gave me 72 hours and we got 15 days.
Wow.
15 days. And that was just long enough to give my son a chance at life.
Yeah. At that development stage, every hour, every day makes such a huge impact. Wow. And we talk so often about how stress is impacting our body and impacting our pregnancy. And no one talks about what to do about it except for like, just go take a nap or go for a walk. But when you're in that heightened stage, that isn't effective. And it does hormonally have such an impact on our bodies.
It does. Yeah. It impacts every single body system. Every single one, because the nervous system is the only body system that touches every other body system.
Wow.
It is connected everywhere. And so to think that it is separate from insert anything is, it's just completely inaccurate. It's not even biologically true.
Yeah.
And I think that's just, that's really when the light bulb went off for me. It was, two days before he was born, I remember having a moment, it was an unusually quiet moment in the room. And I remember thinking and saying out loud, if we both survive this, I'm quitting everything and I'm coming back and I'm teaching women how to do this.
Wow.
Because there's nothing special about me. I don't have any superpowers. I don't have any kind of special anything. We all have a body, so we all can do this. We just need this to become part of standard prenatal care.
Wow. Oh, there's so much to unpack there. So what was that next step of, okay, now I want to go out and like share this information with the world. What brought you to that place in the work that you do today?
Well, it took a few years because then real life kept happening. Right?
And a newborn.
Right, exactly. So he was still born extremely preterm. He was still born in the second trimester. We were in the NICU for a long time. And then there's the post-NICU care that happens with micropreemies that goes on for years.
Yeah.
So that was the priority. But it was kind of a seed that was planted that I kind of went, it's going to sprout when it sprouts. And around the time that he was starting to get ready to go to school and kind of a lot of our medical team was falling away because we didn't need as many people on the team anymore and our schedule opened up a little bit more, that's when I started seeing that sprout come up and go, remember that from a few years ago? What about that now? And so it started with me first diving into the research because as much as I really believed my personal experience of it, my research kind of scientist brain went, was that really real? Is there anything that actually can explain this besides my personal experience? And so I dove into the research and found 70 years worth of data that shows the impact of stress physiology on pregnancy outcomes.
And yes!
I went, what?
and just offshoot here is this is one of the main reasons why I wanted to talk to you because we hear so often of plus size people being told all these stress inducing things that quote will happen to them, which that's not even an evidence-based statement that care providers are saying. And people literally leave their first prenatal visit feeling traumatized, devastated. And for those listening, not everyone, but I'm just saying it happens enough that I'm like, well, what tools can we provide people with? What, because you can do so much to hope that you've connected with a size-friendly care provider, but you're not going to know for sure until you're in that situation. And so often people are made to feel like they will automatically have a high-risk pregnancy. And then for those that do, because it happens to people of all sizes, you're almost made to feel that it's ultimately just because of your weight that you're in this situation and more stress. And it's just such a – it's so hard supporting people of size that knowing that you have other tools and resources that are effective, that are evidence-based, I'm like, oh, I need to have you on the show and to talk about this experience because here you were having a very high-risk pregnancy pregnancy in someone who exists in a smaller body and had access to, oh, we need to get you pregnant right away in your 20s, which is not the case for a lot of people who exist in larger bodies.
That is so, so true. And I think you're just highlighting so correctly all the ways that there are hurdles every step of the way for so many different communities and how unbelievably unfair that is, because so many of those hurdles aren't really even based in biology. Yeah. They're based in our misconceptions of biology, which I struggle to even say that out loud, because how can we have a misconception about biology when it's we've been studying this for how long?
Right.
And there's always more we can learn. Absolutely. But there are some things about our human body, about health, that we have known to not be true or to be true for so long. I mean, that's the thing that blew my mind when I went into the research. I thought this was going to be a new phenomenon people were looking at. 70 years people have known this, and it's not even touching standard prenatal care. And I just went, this is out of control, because everything that we're telling patients now is incomplete if it doesn't include this information, and incomplete and also disempowering, as you were talking about.
Right. Did you find in your research that there was more of an approach of that mind-body connection in the midwifery model of care that tends to be more holistic, or just across the board, you're not seeing any implementation of like, how do you, you know, address stress and that mind-body connection?
It's across the board.
Wow.
I think there are more attempts in the midwifery model. I think where the gap is right now is what stress physiology actually is. Mm-hmm. Because even in the midwifery model, a lot of the recommendations are in this outdated model of the antidote to stress is relaxation. And so take some deep breaths, take a nap, go on vacation, put your feet up, which is the exact it's not the exact opposite, but it is not at all in line with what actually needs to happen to reduce stress. It's not relaxation that is the way out of stress. Relaxation is the outcome of what we have to do to come out of that threat response.
I'm sure you could spend hours talking about what to do, and you have it all in your great book, Pregnancy Brain, but I'm itching to know, you know, a bit more. Could you share a bit more of what we really need to do in those situations?
Yeah. I'll start by saying something really dissatisfying, which is there are no tools for it. We like to think that if I do these two or three or five things, that's going to get me out of it. And it's not, I mean, that's really the whole model of health that I'm wanting to shift and kind of joining forces with people to shift, is it's not that simple. But there is a lot that we can do. And it really begins with going inwards first and building the capacity for sensation. And I think that's something that we completely miss in our current healthcare model. We have a fix-it model. It's something hurts, fix it. I don't feel good, fix it. My body looks like, fix it. And what we miss is actually understanding what those signals actually mean through those sensations. We have learned, as children, we actually have the capability to do it. We don't know what it means, but we are very embodied people as children. And we lose that very early on in life because our culture just doesn't support that. And what we have to do if we want to actually address stress at its root cause is we've got to go inwards and learn how to build the capacity to tolerate that sensation first, whether it's pain, discomfort, anxiety, a racing heart, a tight chest, whatever that is. Learn to tolerate that first, get curious about it, because your body is going to tell you how you need to release it. And it's not going to be deep breathing, and it's not going to be running around the block or punching a pillow. Yeah. It's something very, very small, but really impactful and powerful, but it, you know, dependent on each person's body. And that's really where it begins. When we are living in that state of elevated threat, we're in that threat response, our sensory system is one of the first to actually get impacted. Mm-hmm. And so we lose our ability to actually orient ourselves in our environment, but also to be in our bodies and feel our bodies. And maybe you've heard this from your community as well, but a lot of my clients, when we start working together, there are parts of their body. There's a client who just mentioned to me the other day, I have black holes in my body.
Oh,
like
yeah.
I know I have a leg. I know I have a neck. I can't feel it.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and also you know, like you said, we're innately born with this ability to adapt with stress, and then we lose that. Same with, you know, eating intuitively, right? And then society
yes.
tells us, no, you must diet. So in this case, you know, society tells us, oh no, you must just keep going under the stressful, hard life existence. But what I hear you saying with tuning into your body is something that can be very hard for
yes.
people who have had a lot of trauma with their
yes.
bodies, people who have body dysmorphia, people in marginalized bodies that deal with racism, sexism, fat
yep.
phobia, all of those things combined. So you have this tool that you teach, but there's so many people that don't even know how to even begin to access that innate ability that we all have.
Yes. And I think you bring up a fantastic point is we tend to, I even said this right now, is the ultimate goal is to learn how to tolerate those internal sensations. That is not the place we begin.
Yeah.
Because exactly as you said, when we are living in a body that has been traumatized, we can't feel it.
Right.
And to go in quickly, early, which a lot of these traditional kind of mind-body practices ask you to do, can be re-traumatizing.
Right.
It can be re-triggering. And that's kind of best case scenario almost. There, you know, other side of the spectrum can be, oh my gosh, I can't feel it. I'm completely broken. There's really something wrong with me. And it sends you in that spiral.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely not where we begin. So anyone who's listening, who's like, I can't feel my body, it's okay.
Yeah.
Honestly, with my clients, when we first begin our work together, we don't go inside for body sensations for at least 8 weeks.
Wow.
At least 8 weeks. Like, it doesn't even matter. I know you feel the pain. We're just going to, okay, you tell me when it's past and we're going to keep moving forward, because we start with the external sensations first. We want to orient yourself to your environment first. Can you get that online? Can you access those sensations first? Which is also very difficult to do.
Yeah.
Because our body, if we are living in that threat response, is not meant to be able to smell that rose that you're walking by. Like
mm-hmm.
you don't need to, and so it won't. So
yeah.
it's a lot of retraining of the body. Can I be in my environment? And then later, can I be in my body?
Mm-hmm.
And then much later, can I release that trapped survival stress to go into physiological safety? And then even later from that is, can I stay there?
Yeah. And can I feel safe in the environment? All of this really hits home for me with having an unmedicated childbirth, where I had to learn how to ride my contractions like waves and embrace those
yes.
sensations. Because when I fought, the pain intensified and
exactly.
my labor was longer. But when I learned how to relax into the pain, or, you know, we could use a different word than pain, but I'll say
sure.
pain. When I learned to relax into it and to find ways that my body individualized experience in coping with it, I thought I'd want massage and touch. Heck no, I didn't want any hands on me, but I wanted to be in water in the tub and have my doula there with me, guiding me through it. And it was amazing and transformative what happened, which pretty much is why I do what I do today. And I learned in that moment, like, oh, my body is powerful. I just have never really listened to it, never really trust it, never really allowed myself to tune into my body in
yes.
that way. And then, you know, I was able to have that outcome that I wanted, but in a medical system that isn't designed to allow people to have unmedicated experiences, or even, you know, birth is so regimented now. It's hard for people, even with medicated births, to have certain outcomes and desires that they want as well. So I think with listening you talk through all this, for some people it can be like, wait, what? I don't get it. And it's, for me, it's, you know, some of it too is still trying to understand exactly how this all works. But innately, I know it because I felt it, but
yeah.
I didn't feel it until I was 30 years old, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I like to call this work going back home, because we started out that way.
Yeah.
You know, we are such embodied people. we have to be for survival as children. Mm-hmm. We don't know how to regulate ourselves. We don't have the capacity for that in our bodies at that point. But we're so embodied that we feel all of it and mm-hmm. we express all of it. And that's really where we're going back to. Yeah. It's not a new skill we're learning. We are literally going back to what you already knew how to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that brings a lot of comfort to people because sometimes it can feel really overwhelming of what do I have to do? That sounds really hard.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, it's a lot of work, just like working out. If you start going to the gym for the first time after a long time or running for the first time, you have a learning curve. Absolutely. And you're going back to a body and creating a body that you had before to some degree. It is a functionality you had before.
Yeah.
And maybe the outside looks different, or maybe you feel a little bit different in your body because of age or because of genetics or because of what you've been through and surgeries and all of that. But the internal functionality of it is one we were born with.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can remember that, it sometimes guides us back to, okay, my body knows how to do this. I'm just trying to find the right key for the right door.
And I would love to have that key. I mean, I think a lot of listeners can, you know, relate to going to the doctor for the first time, a new doctor. And it is terrifying. Like, I walk in there with fight or flight. And these days, I think for most of my life, I was ready to fly and run or just assimilate and sit and say, yes, whatever you say, I will do. And now I'm like, oh, I'm ready to fight. And that's not a healthy place to be either, because I literally feel my body tense up, right? I literally feel my body starting to rage because I'm scared of how I'm going to be treated, what people are going to say. So maybe we could start there for people listening who may or may not be having a high risk pregnancy, but may just be even going in to find out, you know, a preconception visit to learn about their fertility options. Where do we even start with how can we feel less of all of this at once and tune into our bodies with walking into these situations that can be very stressful? Yeah, where do we even begin?
Yeah, I think of two places. One is, do you have the right person on your team?
Yeah.
And I think that's a really practical place to begin. And one of the things I often discourage people from doing is if your OB recommended an MFM and you're going to an MFM appointment for a preconception appointment.
Will you tell people what MFM means?
Oh, sure. Yes. MFM stands for maternal fetal medicine specialist. They're also known as a perinatologist, also known as a high-risk OB. They tend to specialize in the high-risk population. They're usually the people you have preconception appointments with if you have a history of health complications or a history of pregnancy complications, preterm birth, things like that. Sometimes you'll do your preconception appointment with your OB. But I often discourage people from taking referrals from their existing medical providers if they are looking for another opinion or another set of eyes, because the people who you're affiliated with are going to be thinking very similarly to the people who are already on your team. If you really want to have a new perspective, go outside of that. And so sometimes that's outside of the clinic. Sometimes it's outside of your city. Sometimes it's outside of your larger area or a different hospital. I've had clients who are willing, especially now with the pandemic and a lot of providers willing to do these consultations across state lines sometimes because they're not doing any kind of medical intervention. We are connecting doctors across state lines, across the country even, to get access to new information you or your providers may not have. So I think that's one place to start, because you know that you are getting a new pair of eyes on what happened before and what you can possibly consider going forward. It's something that I did as well. So I can really attest to that even from a personal perspective of how helpful that is.
That is brilliant. I think we talk so often about trying to find a size-friendly care provider. But when we think of referrals, which often happens, especially if you do have complications during your pregnancy, we just go with what our care provider says. But to think like, oh, I want to go back and do those same steps that I did to research a size-friendly care provider to find whatever that specialty might be, someone who might be size-friendly, which is harder with MFFs.
Yes.
It's harder to find someone who is size-inclusive.
I completely agree. And I would even say across the board, starting with reproductive endocrinology all the way through OB, including MFM, I completely agree that it is very difficult to find size-friendly providers.
Yeah. with your work specifically around high risk, how do you, or what has been some of your experience supporting people with larger bodies that might have, or in marginalized bodies that might have all these additional layers?
A couple things. Definitely, we do a lot of work on navigating the medical system safely. So really, part of the work that I do is pre-appointment prep. Okay, what are you worried about? What are you preparing for? What are you scared about? What are your goals for that appointment? And really almost coaching them. It's not that they don't know. It's that it helps to have somebody else in your corner going, that is not a ridiculous question. And how about let's ask it this way, so it's even more blunt, because you deserve that answer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's a lot of that to make sure that they are really, really seen in that appointment. Even if they've got 5 minutes, 10 minutes, how can we formulate the questions? And what we do, what I provide with my clients is a question workflow, not just a list, but you've got this chart now of, okay, if they say this, then go to this question. If they say this, then go to that question, so that you're making the most out of your time and you're phrasing the questions in a way where you know that you're going to be really heard with the color of the question and not just the words that you're trying to say.
Can you maybe share one example of the language that you find can be more effective with getting answers to your questions?
Yeah. So, for example, a common one that we talk about is always asking why. Mm. Anytime somebody says, okay, I think, you know, everything's looking great, so come back in 3 weeks. Why? What about 3 weeks? What is the rationale behind what you are saying? And the reason for that is you always want to have transparency between what's happening in the provider's head and what you are hearing.
Yeah.
Sometimes the answer to that is, well, insurance won't cover your appointment before 3 weeks. Then that suddenly triggers another question to go, what if something happens? When should I call you before 3 weeks? Because now you want to know what that gap is. One of the things that often leads to a lot of anxiety between appointments is, I don't know what to do if something goes wrong. That is a question that should be answered by your provider in that appointment, so you're not walking out of there wondering, what do I do? That's when that shoe dropping feeling happens.
Yeah.
Is it going to drop now? Is it going to drop now? And that's terrifying, and you don't deserve to live that way. So that's one of the ones that I ask and I encourage my clients to ask all the time, no matter what they tell you. Here's a prescription for XYZ. Why this one?
Yeah.
Is there another one? Why not that one? And really understand their thought process, because that will inform future questions going forward.
I love that. I often talk about the brain acronym, like, what are the benefits? What are the risks? What happens next? Or if I do nothing, but just simply saying why? Like, I think of, like, you know, my son when he was three. Why? But that's how he learned and gained so much information. And while, as a parent, it can get a little redundant, care providers need to be reminded that this is their job. And that so often, especially in maternity care, true informed consent, which means you not just consenting to something, but understanding what you're consenting to is not happening. And I can see how all of these steps and what you teach and what's in your book helps people to feel less stressed from the beginning to help not have those fight or flight responses pop up. And it's a lot of the work that I do too, right? Empowering people when your care provider spouts off relative risk, which is comparing the rate of someone in a smaller body to someone in a larger body, and the risk difference, where often you'll hear, oh, you're, you know, five times more likely to incur gestational diabetes. And what I've been teaching is, well, ask, what is my actual risk? Because being told you're five times more likely, I mean, that makes my blood pressure rise, right? Just hearing that.
But hearing,
you've got about an 85% chance of not incurring gestational diabetes, and that's not a number that's fixed, and here are all the things that you can do. Okay, I'm breathing a little easier. But as you've said from the beginning, medical professionals aren't trained in how to present things or talk about things in a way that doesn't create this often knee-jerk reaction, primarily because they don't have the time. They aren't given the time. And so they're doing the best they can. Sometimes, not always. Everyone has their individualized biases, but it's the system, right? That's really, really broken. So how can we even navigate the system, let alone not be triggered and traumatized throughout walking through the system?
Yes, exactly. Those are all the questions that need to be answered and need to be addressed, because as much as I actually love doing this strategic work with my clients and these question workflows and appointment prep and reviewing, you know, test results to prepare for their, you know, all these, I love doing that. And every time I do it, I do get a little upset on their behalf of this burden shouldn't be so much on you. And I'm grateful that I can carry some of that on their behalf, but there should be a much better system you are a part of that can do a lot of this for you so that you're not having to constantly be checking as the patient who is going through, in my case, high-risk pregnancies and worried about your baby and doing all of this. Like, that's not fair. We've got to come in from the other door and really start making big shifts inside the system as well and supporting providers in a way where they can show up in a much better, a more effective way in the way that patients need.
As a certified childbirth educator specializing in plus-size pregnancy for over a decade, I've become frustrated with how the information shared in popular pregnancy apps, websites, and magazines doesn't always align with having a plus-size pregnancy. So I've written an evidence-based week-by-week plus-size pregnancy breakdown just for you. Head to plussizebirth.com to sign up for the Plus Size Pregnancy Week by Week Breakdown Series. Best of all, it's completely free. So go to plussizebirth.com today. Now, back to the show.
I spent so long in my work kind of just focusing on how to have a healthy plus size pregnancy because I was just trying to change the narrative and the stigma that people of size feel. But absolutely, people of all sizes have high risk pregnancies, but that doesn't always mean that there's going to be poor outcomes or poor birth experiences at all in any way, shape, or form. But when we place that label of high risk, it automatically creates that stress, you know, like, oh, now things are wrong. And now I have all these extra appointments and all these extra things. And it's almost like you're setting yourself up on a path for more complications because of how we might react to it, how we're talked to, what we have to go through. So you're providing this key to unlock of, yes, we want to have healthy outcomes, right? For people during pregnancy and babies, but how can we do that in a way that doesn't stress induce other complications or exacerbate things that people are experiencing throughout their pregnancy, whether it be preeclampsia or gestational diabetes or having, you know, individualized health concerns going into pregnancy.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Why isn't this talked about? Like, literally, why are we not teaching people how not to get so stressed out when you're saying we've got like 70 plus years of research, evidence-based information to say, hey, stress, not so good. And our bodies are innately, it have the ability to help us reduce that, yet we don't know how to do that anymore. And that's not being trained.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, all of that. Exactly. And I touch upon this a little bit at the beginning of the book when I'm setting up, and I think it's in the introduction where I think a lot of where this breaks down is the fact that we talk about the mind-body connection. Now, that is technically in the title of my book. That is for SEO purposes more than anything. But there's no such thing as a mind-body connection. It is one body.
Right.
There's no separation. And just as we talked about earlier, the nervous system is the body system that touches every single body system. We don't exist without that inherent connection. And I think that breaks down in the medical training that providers have when it is completely discounted as an integral part of healthcare. It is not part of their training. They don't have access to it. So the recommendations they're giving, when I think there are a lot of providers who are starting to get on the train of, yep, stress does impact. I mean, we see this in oncology, we see this in cardiology really picking up more So I think obstetrics is very slow on the uptake on this one, but there are some who are kind of recognizing it. But because they don't have the training of what is stress, what is stress physiology, the recommendations are ones that are not actually based in physiology. Just relax, go put your feet up, take a nap, take a vacation. That's not how you actually release stress from your body.
What would you like to see care providers telling their patients?
I would like them to actually educate their patients on what stress physiology is and how it impacts pregnancy complications, pregnancy outcomes, and just the health of the pregnancy the same way that they talk to patients about this is the prenatal vitamin that you need. These are kind of the dietary restrictions with a giant asterisk because I know that's problematic on its own. But, you know, the way that we talk about other aspects of health, this has to be a part of that conversation.
Yeah.
And it cannot be you need to stress less because that's ridiculous.
That's impossible.
That is not the answer.
But we need tools to get through the stress, and that's individualized from what I'm understanding.
That's right.
There's not like A, B, and C. Well, you know, that would be too simple. It's a very individualized experience. And so your recommendations is to start, you know, just by your environment and acknowledging what we're experiencing, what we're feeling, and then to work towards internally next, which again, as we've said, can be really scary for people who have been through trauma. And I think we're just now, I think you would agree with me, starting to redefine what trauma means, especially for women in healthcare, because so many things have been done to our bodies that we thought were supposed to happen, or we didn't realize that we could say no. We didn't realize that care providers should be asking us before we touch our bodies. That would you agree with me that most people, many people have, especially people who are self-identify as women, who have been traumatized by the healthcare system?
Yeah. I do agree with that. And I think the way it shows up is going to be individualized, and how much it has impacted our health is going to be individualized. But yeah, I think the system is set up to not or discourage consent. It is set up so that we are disconnected from our bodies. It is set up so the expert is on a pedestal and we as the patient are below. We are looking to them for answers. I mean, all of these things play a role in experiencing anything inside that exam room or inside that labor and delivery room as traumatic. Things like not being told, what does a high risk even mean? I think if there's one question I get more often than anything else, it is a message from somebody saying, my doctor just told me I'm high risk. What the heck does that mean? We start filling in what that could possibly mean. And that's not saying we create our own stress. It's that there's a vacuum that's been created and nobody else is filling it. So we're going to fill it for ourselves with things that we may or may not know. And so I think the whole system is absolutely designed, not intentionally. I just don't think that it was a value to value women's bodies. And that's the foundation of the way the medical system, especially in women's healthcare, actually has been built. And it hasn't changed, unfortunately.
Yeah. And then I think of when I'm in those situations that cause stress, then I often turn to things for coping that aren't necessarily what I should be turning to, whether it be alcohol or food, because that's what I've learned to self-soothe with. Not everyone, and I'm not saying every person who exists in a larger body, I'm speaking from my personal narrative. So even just learning how to sit with how I'm feeling and talk myself through it rather than immediately grab for a glass of wine, which is what I did all of 2020. And then I've shared on the show how I've really worked very hard not to turn to alcohol. But during pregnancy, some of our go-to vices are often stripped away. So learning how to cope in more healthier ways and healthier tools just from the beginning can be hard and tricky to even understand where to start and where to sit with everything.
Yeah. Let me give you an example that came to mind as you were talking. So I work with clients oftentimes where they feel a lot of anger is what comes up. And our culture is not great about encouraging women to express anger, especially women of color, especially Black women. We just kind of really got to keep it together. We don't express that. And so I remember having a conversation with this particular client, and she was talking about how this anger is coming up, and she's feeling like it feels like something wants to burst out of her skin, but she's not letting it. And I think in traditional models, we would talk about go ahead and feel it and express it. And how does it want to come out? And the way that I work, which is tied to what I was saying earlier about accessing your environment versus accessing the outside first, is my question to her was, do you have access to your peripheral vision right now?
Wow.
Because when we are feeling that level of anger or that rage, like I said earlier, our sensory system is impacted in a way that is supportive of the state, the threat state that we're in. So for example, if that anger is tied to flight, we lose our peripheral vision mm-hmm. because we have to have tunnel vision to be able to get out of that threatening situation. Mm-hmm. And so we start doing that exploration first. Do you have access to that? Can you smell the things around you? What can you hear? Because sound, that auditory sense has been impacted, whether we are in flight versus freeze. Mm-hmm. Where can we access that, right? So you can see that we're not even touching the sensation yeah. of anger yet. We're not even going there yet. We're getting curious about her surroundings mm-hmm. in a way that is informing her and me watching this happen, what state she's in, because that is going to tell us what we need to do to release what's coming yeah. out, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I find that to be really helpful because I know you've said this a few times and it's so true. It is terrifying to go into your body when you have been traumatized in your body. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely terrifying. And so these body scans and these internal kind of work, and oftentimes even a lot of different yoga practices, meditation practices ask you to go inwards, but it's often too soon. Mm-hmm. And so instead, can you, as you're talking about sitting with the experience, start with your external senses.
Yeah.
What can I see? What can I smell? What can I hear, taste? What can I touch? And get really curious about it, because they're all kind of in this strange, seemingly strange, but physically predictable pattern. If you can find it, you can restore some of that balance. And in doing that, that overwhelming sense, in this case, I'm talking about this client with anger, that actually starts to dissipate on its own.
Mm.
It starts to dissipate on its own until it becomes concentrated into the smaller ball. That's how I picture it, at least, of something we can hold in our hand and we go, oh, that's what this is about.
That feels a lot less
overwhelming. This I can deal with, I can process, I can talk about, I can whatever it is that you need to do.
Thank you for walking through that. And it helps me to identify also things that I talk about, like using an essential oil sometimes before going into stressful situations. So I have something to smell, or I have a ring that I like to twist. So I've found my own coping mechanisms, but I find in certain situations, I don't even think of those things, right?
Exactly.
Like, you get so stressed out. So it's like a repetitive, it's reteaching yourself, as you've been saying from the beginning. And that is real hard. Okay. So on that note, how do we learn? So tell us about Pregnancy Brain and tell us about all of your work.
Sure. So Pregnancy Brain is the book that kind of consolidates a lot of the cornerstones of the 70 years of research that I stumbled upon, in combination with some of my personal experiences and my client experiences, to really show the impact of supporting stress physiology to improve pregnancy outcomes. I mean, the intention of that book is really to show you how much choice you do have, how there is hope, but that's built in biology and not just this kind of hallmarky thing that we talk about, and how much power you really have to support your body in a way to actually change the outcomes that are being kind of presented to you as, well, this will happen, or this is very likely to happen. One of the reasons actually that I really wanted to write the book that way is I remember being in that hospital bed and hearing these statistics, first from my OB and my perinatologist, and then later from the neonatologists, of these are all the horrible things that could happen. And my head kept going to, you're not saying 100%. That means there's a chance. So my head goes to, what do I need to do to get into that category? Wow. And that's essentially the kind of work that I do, is how do we get you into that category? So that's what the book is about. It's available, I think, on Amazon, Kindle, paperback. You can order it from local bookstores and from your library. And then I work, one-on-one with clients. I've got a membership for people who just want to learn more about stress physiology and trauma-informed women's health. There's a lot of resources on my website, so you can head over to my website, barijatdeshpande.com. And I hang out on Instagram. So if you want to come by and say hi, I would love to meet your listeners.
Yes, I love your Instagram. You share such great tidbits. And your podcast, too, that while you're not continuously recording it, the Delivering Miracles, you have over 130 episodes with a wealth of information and knowledge. And yeah, I feel so validated listening to your episodes, too.
Thank you.
In a lot of those experiences, because yeah, to have that innate ability and to tune back into ourselves. I feel like a lot of the work that we do is giving especially women back their power that they've always had. And that's really rewarding work. It's just more frustrating that this isn't, that we have to fight to create this change.
Agreed. Agreed. And I'm hopeful that with the efforts that people like you and I and other advocates are doing, at some point, we're creating a much better system for our children and hopefully their children who won't have to fight anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you say that the Pregnancy Brain book is just a good starting point for understanding all this? Obviously, working with you too, if someone has the ability to do that, but a book can be something that someone can access for free at a library. Is that a good starting place to just really understanding all that we've talked about throughout this time, or Instagram or all of the above, but what was your recommendation?
Yeah, I find typically it's kind of a triad. Get the book, listen to Delivering Miracles, and then follow me on Instagram. And between those three, you start to get a good sense of kind of what we've been talking about from various angles about various topics. I think the step after that, if you're not quite ready for one-on-one, is to join me in my inner circle, which is the membership where we talk a lot about this, but even more nerdy. And like, I get really excited about this stuff, about just, it's a trauma-informed approach to women's health. How can our nervous system and our physiology explain and help us through a variety of different health issues, preconception through pregnancy and even outside of pregnancy. So we cover a lot of different topics there.
Yeah.
And then whenever you're ready beyond that, I work with a very, very small number of one-on-one clients every year. And so you can certainly reach out for that too after at that point.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for the work that you're doing. I just think of so many areas of my life where I could learn better how to tap into all of this. Sometimes even just having a hard day going to the grocery store can be hard, existing in a larger body and people looking at you and looking at your cart and all this BS. And you're just like, I just want to buy groceries, let alone someone who is plus size and just wants to find a fertility specialist that will not just tell them to lose weight and go on with your day, when we know that the fertility window is not infinite, right? We know that, you know, there are risks for people of all sizes with pregnancy, but not just because you are labeled as high risk does not mean that you will automatically have poor outcomes for you and your baby. And in fact, some people really like that label because they have additional testing and oversight. And I think a lot of what you have done too, which we didn't talk about as much, as helping to like even just remove that stigma around that label and classification, which is so incredibly important. And thank you for the work that you've been doing around that too.
Thank you. I appreciate your support so much. And thank you as well for everything that you're doing. I know our worlds collide a lot, and there are so many people that in my community who have benefited from your work and advocacy as well. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, I hope everyone will head over to plusmommy.com where you'll find all of your resources. And then I want to be sure to mention your Instagram, because we're big fans of Instagram over here on the show, and to have people tap into different Instagram handles immediately. So your Instagram is healthy.highriskpregnancy, right?
That's right.
I got it. Well, thank you again for everything that you do, for who you are, and everything that you stand for, because I'm a big fan and I have a lot to learn. So thank you so much, Parijot, for everything.
Thank you, Jen.
All right. Have a great day, friends. Until next time. Bye.
Bye.